So we're just launched into a series on some things in the Gospel of Matthew. Today we're going to begin the Sermon on the Mount. We just looked at the temptations of Jesus as he gets declared to be the Son of God. So the earth is about to see, and it has never seen, the ministry of the only beloved Son. Satan comes and tempts Jesus, says, if you're the Son of God, use your sonship this way or that way. So tempted both Jesus, I think he can still tempt us. How do you make use of your sonship? What do you use it for? How do you deploy it? Jesus resists those temptations, and now he's about ready to begin the ministry of the only begotten Son of God. And in Matthew, it begins with the Sermon on the Mount, which goes from chapters 5 to 7. And I just want to make a couple preliminary comments about it before we kind of jump in and look at the opening verses. But a good question is who is the sermon for? So I'm going to show you just the opening two verses and the closing two verses of the Sermon on the Mount. We'll put them up there on the screen. So the first two verses of chapter 5 and the last two verses of chapter 7. This is how it starts. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountain. So there's a picture, like too many people here, I'm leaving, he goes up on the mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and began to teach them, that is his disciples, saying, and then you get all the things that he says to his disciples, teaching them. But then the last two verses, chapter 7, when Jesus had finished these words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes. So that's the last two verses of summary. So the question, who is the sermon for? My own answer to that is the sermon is for the disciples of Jesus. You know, that's who come to him, and Jesus speaks to them. So it's his disciples. It's Jesus' followers. It's his disciples. They are the ones who are to be taught by what Jesus says. But there's also a sense where it's for the multitudes. It's for the crowds. He leaves them behind, but you know they just hang around. They're like the audience or something in the background. They audit the course. They're not taking it for credit, but they're auditing it or witnessing it. And for them, it's the whole sermon is, so what do you think of Jesus saying to those who follow him? What do you make of that? And they're amazed at it. You know, they're amazed at that teaching, that he's teaching us as one who has authority rather than their own scribes. So my own perspective is the sermon is for Jesus' disciples. They are to be taught by it, but it's for the crowds to witness and see what it is Jesus is saying to his followers. And I think they would be amazed by that. And they're amazed at the teaching and the authority that goes with it. So whenever in the sermon we read you, when Jesus says you are the salt of the earth, he doesn't mean the crowds, he means his disciples. That's how I'm going to handle it, at least. And just one other preliminary comment. In the sermon, Jesus is going to give lots of instruction about how to live and what to do. Many of the ethical instructions that Jesus gives are found in the Sermon on the Mount. And you, even if you don't at the moment know that they're found there, you know that Jesus said them probably, or that they're in the Bible. That when somebody strikes you, turn the other cheek. If you're asked for a shirt, also give the person who's asking your coat. Go the second mile. Comes from the Sermon on the Mount. Love your enemies. Don't be anxious about your life, about what you shall eat or drink or wear or put on. If you look with lust in your heart, you've already committed adultery. You know, do not judge. That's in the Sermon on the Mount. You are to be perfect, like your Heavenly Father is perfect. So there's a whole bunch of instructions about what to do and how to live in the Sermon on the Mount. And that raises the question, are you really supposed to do it? Or even more, can it be done? Many have answered no to that question. That Jesus is just presenting the ideal, but he's not presenting the realistic. So he's just kind of showing us where the bar is, but nobody can actually reach the bar or go over the bar. So many have given that type of answer to the Sermon on the Mount. Here's an ideal ethic, but nobody actually can live this way. Nobody can actually do this. It's just a presentation of the ideal. Or some have said it's not for the here and now. This is how it's going to be in the new age, you know, the next dispensation, when kind of everything is made right and Jesus comes back in glory. Then, when the lion lies down with the lamb, then these things, then people will be able to turn the other cheek, they'll be able to go the second mile, they won't have anything bad in their heart, etc. So it's not for the here and now. Or some have said it's for the deeper life club. It's not for your run-of-the-mill ordinary Christians, it's for the deeper life club. It's counsels of perfection for monks and nuns, people who live away from the world out there all by themselves in a little shack or a big shack, doesn't matter. You know, don't do anything much but pray and eat. It's for them. You know, they can live this way. It's for kind of super saints. So some have done that with the Sermon on the Mount. Others have said it should just be your internal attitude, even if it can't be your external action. Inside, you should be willing to turn the other cheek. Of course, you can't actually do that because we know that that subsidizes evil and people will just take advantage of that. So you can't actually do it externally, but inside, you should be willing to turn the other cheek for that other person's good or something like that. So really, can't be external actions, but it can point to admirable or desirable internal attitudes. So in many ways, a lot of people have said, no, you can't actually do this, or it can't be done. I'm going to be rather straightforward about it. I think Jesus wants his disciples to live this way. I think he wants Christians to live this way. So all the things that he says you're supposed to do this, I think he wants us to do exactly that. Especially and centrally in our life together, you know, as fellow Christians, as fellow believers, as fellow followers of Christ, but he also wants us to live this way with respect to our neighbors. This is how he wants his people to be. Though also, I do not think Jesus is giving in the Sermon on the Mount a public ethic. There's a big discussion there, and I'm just going to skirt it here for a second. But Jesus does not give in the Sermon on the Mount what ought to be the platform for the Democratic or Republican Party, so that the Democratic Party is more godly if they have in their platform that we believe in turning the other cheek when somebody smites you on one side. Jesus is not given some type of public ethic. The Sermon on the Mount is not the agenda for right American values, though some try to use it that way. I think that's a misuse of the Sermon on the Mount. Some, you're trying to get those who are not Jesus' followers to adhere to Jesus' ethic, and that does not work. You're trying to get people to live like Christians who do not believe in Christ. That doesn't work, in my opinion. So it's not a public ethic, but it is the ethic for those who genuinely know and follow Christ. Just one more thing before we launch into the text. I want to encourage us all, while in Matthew, to think a lot about what it is that you do. Matthew focuses a lot on what's to be done, even in the Sermon on the Mount. It's full of things to be done. He doesn't encourage us in that sense very much to be believers and trust in your heart and get your doctrine straight. He wants you to do things, live certain ways. So it's good for us, I think, as we read Matthew, for all of us to just think a lot about what you do and the works that are produced and take place in your own life. We'll see that in the Sermon on the Mount. We'll start there, but it's not just in the Sermon on the Mount. It's all through Matthew. All kinds of focus on what it is that you actually say, what it is that you actually do. And I encourage us all just to think a lot about that. But Jesus does not begin his teaching with instructions about things to do. There's going to be a lot of that, but he does not begin that way. He does not begin by teaching about things that ought to be done. Rather, he begins with mentioning folks who are blessed. That's how he starts, the Beatitudes. So he's going to give a list of these folks are blessed. And as he mentioned, these folks are the blessed folks, throughout, as he gives that list, the main evidence that they're blessed, okay, they're blessed, what does that mean? The main evidence that they're blessed is the outcomes which those people experience, those outcomes that they will experience, all except one, I think, are in the future tense. So the main mark of the blessing, the main evidence of the blessing, is the outcomes that these people will experience in the future. There's not a, they're blessed because see what they got now. There's not that type of argument. Go look at their houses, go look at their cars, go look at their jobs, go look at their families. You'll see that they're blessed because of the things they got now. There's not that. They're called blessed because this is what's going to happen to them. This is what will happen to them. In the scriptures, the outcome is always decisive. It's how it ends that really matters. There's a great passage in Jeremiah where the people are sinning and the priests are going in with it and the prophets are agreeing with it and everybody is having a good time. But the Lord raises a simple question, but what will you do at the end of it? Of all those scientists right now who are ruling God out of their theories, that's part of how I would respond to them. Great, have a good time, celebrate. What are you going to do at the end of it? That's the critical question, because it's the end that's decisive. It's the outcome that's decisive. And for the scripture, if the road ends in a bad place, if the road ends in death, it's not a blessed road. No matter how much fun you had on it, if it ends in death, that's not a blessed road. And in the Beatitudes, the blessed do indeed obtain, will obtain, very desirable ends, very great ends. You know, they're going to see God. They're going to receive the kingdom. They're going to be satisfied. They're going to inherit the earth. They're going to know comfort. They're going to get a great reward in heaven. So the outcomes indeed are desirable and they are indeed great. But so who are these blessed ones? Yeah. Jesus starts off by not giving instructions, but giving a list of folks who are blessed. Who are these folks? Who is it that can expect? Who is it that can anticipate such outcomes of inheriting the kingdom and seeing God and of inheriting the earth and knowing comfort and being satisfied? Who are those folks? So as we read it now, and probably the Beatitudes are familiar to nearly all of us, here's my own main concern, my main hope. Also my suggestion. I'm not trying to get you to ask today, as we read the Beatitudes, am I like that? Am I like what Jesus just said that blessed person is? Am I like that? Don't ask that. Nor draw the conclusion I need to be more like that. It says, blessed are the merciful, oh, I need to be more merciful. So I'm encouraging, don't go down that path. Am I like that? Am I merciful? Or I need to be more like that? Because Jesus says those persons are blessed. Rather, I would like you to treat them this way. I would like for each one of us to get from the Beatitude, get posters to put up in your room. Get posters to put up over your fireplace. The same way that if you're nuts about movies or something like that, or the entertainment industry, maybe when you were growing up, maybe still, you'll get a poster of some movie star and you'll put that up in your den. Maybe if you're into sports, you'll get a couple sports heroes. You'll get a Michael Jordan thing or Jack Nicklaus thing or Tiger Woods thing. And you put that poster up of that great sports icon. Maybe if you're like, you know, political things, you'll get a picture of Lincoln or Churchill or something like that, you know, some great influential political leader, and you'll put up his poster. Maybe if you're a business person, then some entrepreneur, Steve Jobs, is that his name? Steve Jobs, yeah. You know, or Rockefeller or some oil tycoon or something like that. You know, you get their picture and put them up. So do something like that with the Beatitudes. Jesus is going to give you a set of posters to hang up. Jesus, in a sense, is saying to us, here's a set of posters. These are the good guys. And I want you just to take the posters and don't first say, am I like that person or I need to be like that, but just, these are the good guys. I'm going to, you know, hang them up in my room. So that's my main concern, that these would hang up in your room over your fireplace in your den, you know, as, okay, these are the good guys. So let's just read it, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. So I'm encouraged, just Jesus handing you like 8 or 9 posters. Here's a picture of the poor in spirit. Okay, honey, where do you want me to put that? Here's a poster of the merciful. Here's a poster of a peacemaker. So who are these blessed ones that get that desirable and great outcome? Jesus gives us a list of folks. He gives us a set of posters. And perhaps it's not real easy. I'm going to briefly review each one in a moment, but it's not easy, actually, to say exactly or be confident that you said fully who and what each one of those words means. But this part is certain, isn't it? That Jesus' set of posters of the good guys is not whom we would expect. That's really certain. If we ask, well, who gets the best stuff? Who gets the kingdom and gets to inherit the earth and to know comfort and be satisfied and get a great reward at the end? Who gets the best stuff? I mean, who gets to be on the posters? We might expect, well, there'll be some pictures of movers and shakers, right? They get to be on the posters. You know, it'd be a picture of the powerful, the celebrities. They would be on the posters. It's the pretty, the handsome, the gorgeous folks. It's the strong people who get to be on the posters. It's the intelligent ones. It's those who take charge. Those who have a can-do type of attitude. Those are the people that are on the posters. But Jesus doesn't have any of those people on the posters that he just handed us. So draw from that the obvious conclusion. I say it's obvious, and I think it is, but it's often an unwanted conclusion. And the obvious conclusion, I think, is when Jesus hands you those posters and said, these are the good guys, you look through the set, you go, Jesus is a different drummer. That's your conclusion. These are the good guys. You got a different song going to a different beat. As soon as he hands us those folks, says, these are the blessed, we should all realize this is a different deal. So I encourage you to draw that conclusion. This is a different deal. It's so easy to want Jesus to be the way to do the world. That's what we would like Jesus to do. I already have the posters on the wall. I want Jesus to help me be like those folks I already got hanging on the wall. But Jesus is not the way to do the world well. Jesus is the way to do godliness, and godliness is different. So just who Jesus has on the posters, it's a reminder to us that you can't be a friend of God and a friend of the world. You cannot do both. Jesus doesn't help you be a friend of the world. He'll help you be a friend of God, but you can't be both a friend of God and a friend of the world. The things highly esteemed among men are detested by God. So all of us have to choose that if we love the world, the love of the Father is not in us. That if you desire to be blessed by God and saluted by the world, you're desiring something that's not possible. You know, we can wish that it were so, but it's not possible. You know, if you want to be saluted by the world, you're not going to be blessed by God. It's a different deal. So as soon as Jesus says these are the folks who are blessed, and it doesn't include any of the folks that the world would put up as far as the people that have the great outcomes and are, you know, the people that get in the newspapers or put on the TV shows or make the big salaries or whatever, it has to teach us it's a different deal, a different drummer. The Beatitudes are about people with certain attributes, and they're also about people in certain situations. I think both of those things are present. So the Beatitudes include, you know, some talk about a certain kind of person, a kind of person who is blessed. But it also talks about settings where the blessing occurs. So the posters are of people that we don't expect. I didn't expect to see him, I didn't expect to see her on the poster. So it's a different kind of person you expect. But also, the posters are of settings, of places that you didn't expect either. They're not pictures of the strong and the mighty. Those are attributes of people. They'll get on the poster because they're strong and mighty. It's not that. But neither is it pictures of the halls of power. Not a bunch of Capitol buildings in the background. Not the 40-story office building of which, you know, you're the CEO of or something like that. But in the background, the setting, the situation is unanticipated too. So it speaks both to certain kinds of people that are blessed in certain situations where the blessing happens. So I want to just do the list real simply. Not exhaustively. I mean, we could take multiple Sundays probably on each one. But I want you to just page through your posters. That's all I want you to do right now. Just look briefly at each one. So poor in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Whatever that means exactly, for sure it's not a word about richness. Not a word about fullness. Not something about abundance. About folks who have more. Rather, it's a word about lack. A word about poverty. Things are missing. There's need. It's about less. These are people who wouldn't sing a song, less of Jesus, less of the Spirit. They're thinking more love, more power. There's like, we could do it more. Now I got too much. So Jesus says, those are blessed who don't have it all. Jesus says, those are blessed who feel the need for more. These are folks, people who are poor in spirit don't have the spirit dripping off of them, off their fingertips. Now, these aren't PhDs in spirit. I don't know if there is such a thing, but if there is, Jesus isn't talking about them. Jesus isn't talking about spiritual giants. He says those are blessed who can realize in spirit things, which are very important, that they don't have it all. They know they need more. They know there's some lack. They know there's some poverty. Those folks are blessed. That's who's on the poster. Those who mourn. Blessed are those who mourn. I think the idea here is that not blessed are the emotional types, but blessed are those who know sorrow. People who are touched by and people who know the brokenness of earth. You know, earth can be stunning in its beauty. It really can be. Earth can be thrilling in its adventure. Earth can be delightful in its circumstance. But also, earth has a way of turning out wrong. Earthly life always reminds me of one of my favorite phrases in Lord of the Rings, where two of the folks say, you know, for years uncounted, we have fought the long defeat. You know, that's what earthly life is. We're all fighting the long defeat, right? Until you finally lose for good. So, earthly life has a way of turning out wrong. And those who mourn are people who know what it means to say, you know, my heart hurts. My heart hurts for perhaps things in my own situation. My heart hurts for people in other situations. Perhaps the kind of thing that we all, Heidi's not here today because she came yesterday and she's all worn out. Probably all of us, our heart hurts for what earthly life is for Heidi, right? That earth is like that. Godly woman who loves the Lord and serves the Lord, beautiful family, and but difficult disease and hard circumstances, our heart hurts for that. We mourn over that. Jesus says those people are blessed who are touched by and know the sorrow of earth. It's a remarkable thing. It's an insightful thing. Most of us probably know some verses that occur towards the end of Romans 8. So who knows some verse that's close to the end of Romans 8? Just kind of get started on it. Okay, Greg.
You know, all things work good for those who love the Lord.
Okay, we know that all things work together for good. Okay, that's there. Anybody else? Okay, Barry.
For nothing shall separate us from the love of God.
You know, what can separate? Nothing shall separate us from the love of God. Neither height, nor depth, nor angels, nor principalities, nor life, nor death. You know, any other created thing. Nothing will separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. But yes, if God is for us, who can be against us? We just sang that. That's drawn from Romans 8. If our God's on our side, throw everything that there is against us, who could be against us? Those are all things at the end of Romans 8. They are awesome passages. They're great. Romans 9, verse 2. Just after Paul has written that stuff about all things work together for good, nothing can separate us. I am persuaded that nothing can separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus. We overwhelmingly conquer in everything because of Christ. You know, if God is for us, who can be against us? Just after Paul has written those things, he writes Romans chapter 9, verse 2. I encourage you to memorize it. Anybody know what it says?
But I have great sorrow and continual grief in my heart.
I have great sorrow and unceasing grief in my heart. There's a little change of feel and emotion, isn't it? How could Paul, kind of two verses away from that stuff he just said, right, I have great sorrow and unceasing grief in my heart. But he does. There's somebody who knows what it means to mourn. And he's talking about his fellow Jews. You know, he himself is taking the gospel to the Gentiles because the Jews have rejected it. But that causes enduring sorrow and enduring grief in his heart that he carries all the time. Blessed are the gentle. The world tends to have a perspective that nice guys finish last, right? Jesus' perspective is nice guys inherit the earth. That's Jesus' perspective. I mean, it's a word that references both disposition and style. It's the disposition of you put others before yourself. I think you put others before yourself, not in a labored, fussy, Jesus wants me to put you in front, you please go first. Not a labored, fussy, kind of make you gay type of thing. No, but a natural, easy way. I like you, why don't you go first? I'd like for you to be first. And also gentle means putting others before things, before agendas, before programs, and before plans. Do you ever find somebody who will run over and trample anybody and everybody for the sake of their agenda or their program? Like whatever that is, it's not gentle. So others before things. The approach to others here is very much realizing others are precious. Others don't belong to me. They're not here for me to just manipulate and do with what fits my agenda or my program. And also, I probably don't know nearly all of what's going on with that person. There's lots of mystery, lots of depth, lots of things I don't know. So I'm not a bull in the china shop. I'm gentle because there's lots of mysteries and wonders here with others that I don't know about. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. That's a beatitude about what is wanted, what is desired. More important than what you have right now, more important than what you don't have right now, more important than the situation that you're currently in, more important than opportunities that are before you or opportunities that are not before you, more important than hindrances or roadblocks that may be there, are more important than anything than any of those things is what is wanted. What's desired? What is desired and what is wanted doesn't always show. I mean, we can be very good at hiding it, concealing it, masking it. You might be sitting there hungering and thirsting for righteousness, and next to you is a person who wants to be rich. And you both look pretty much the same. You both sang a while ago, you're both, but you desire different things. So it doesn't always show, but God knows, and it matters to Him. And He says, blessed are those folks that when they speak, when they act, when they relate to others, when they deal with stuff in their lives, that what they want, what they hunger and thirst for, is righteousness. That when you deal with Patty, when you talk to Patty, when you think about Patty, you know, when you have dinner with Patty, that what you want, what you desire, is righteousness. Blessed are those folks. Blessed are the merciful. Two things about that. That when you're with people and when you're in situations, to be merciful, you have good things to give. You don't go, I got nothing. You can't be merciful if you go, I got nothing, right? So you have good things to give. And then what you give has more compassion in it, more tenderness, more kindness, more forbearance, more forgiveness than what you could give, or than what the situation or person would seem to merit. I have something to give, and it has more compassion than perhaps the situation merit, more forbearance, and it might be called for more forgiveness. That's what it means to be merciful. Have something to give, and it abounds on the merciful and compassionate and pity side and patient side. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure in heart. I think here, similar to those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, it's very much about what's within. For all of us, the externals of life are often messy and they're often full of mixture. None of us has the time to do all that we would like to do. You know, none of us has the time to be with each other, you know, to kind of like get to know each other and fellowship to the extent and to the degree and as often as we would like to. The situations that we in are often a mixture. There's multiple influences, there's many inputs. We're always in situations that have limitations and compromise and partialness. You know, that's the order of the day. But it's good if on the inside, even as you navigate all that partialness and limitation and mixture and messiness, and it's good if on the inside there's purity, singleness, a consistency, and that what's there in purity is a good thing and it's a holy thing. Jesus hands us a poster and says, these folks are blessed who inside have a purity in their heart. Peacemakers. Not peacekeepers, no, but peacemakers. A peacekeeper is one who will do anything and say anything to keep the boat from rocking. You know, a peacemaker is somebody who themselves possess what they need so they don't rock the boat, and a person who can help others possess what they need so that they can stay in the boat. That's what makes for peace. Not just somebody who will accommodate and give in and wilt and talk out of both sides of their mouth in order for the boat not to be rocked. Not that. But somebody who knows how to make peace, possesses the things that are necessary for the situation to be peaceful. And then just one more. Put those last two together. Blessed are those when bad things happen to good people. Blessed are those when bad things happen to good people because they are good. This is the only beatitude that Jesus Himself makes personal, where He says, blessed are you. I think one of the reasons He does that is we can admire, we do admire. We prayed earlier for brothers and sisters in the Middle East, other places of the world where there are lots of persecution and for their faith. We can endure those. We can admire those who endure persecution for righteousness' sake in the Middle East, and who endure persecution for righteousness' sake in Africa. But let it happen to me, something that comes my way because of righteousness. And the first thing I say is, that's not fair. Right? Now, why me? I don't understand this. They're accusing me falsely. And I'm going to send out an email right away to correct the situation. So Jesus says, blessed are you when it happens to you. You know, not just in Africa, not just in the Middle East, or the distance of the ocean we seek. That's cool that they're suffering for righteousness' sake. But I'll recognize it when it happens close to home. So there's kind of brief looks at the posters in your hand. Again, I encourage you, don't take them as secret exhortations, where Jesus is underhandedly saying, I want you to be like this, or you need to be a little bit more like this. The point isn't to exhort you to be more merciful, to be more gentle, to mourn. Rather, take them as posters that you're going to hang up. This is what Jesus said. He started off this way, says, these are the good guys in my deal. Be reminded in them that the blessings of God get expressed in the outcome. What it will be like at the end marks these folks as blessed. Not necessarily what they have right now. What they will know, experience, and have at the end. Let it remind you, that's what God means by blessed. But then let them just hang in the room of your soul. Let it sink into you, these are the good guys, you know. Let it teach us that Jesus is saying, my playing field is different than the world's playing field. It's a different drummer, it's a different game, just works and looks different. We are after different things. We're after being different kind of people, and we're after welcoming different situations and different experiences. So not secret exhortation or an underhanded prod of some sort, but just an explanation of reality. Take them as that. An explanation of Jesus' reality. These are the folks who are blessed. Then one more point. If we are people who heed all of the instructions about right to come from the Lord's mouth in the rest of the sermon, and they're going to come fast and furious. If we heed those, if we actually do them, I think we will end up looking a lot like those people on the posters that he just handed to us. That if we heed all the things that he says, if we do them, we'll end up looking like people who are poor in spirit, who mourn, who are gentle, who hunger and thirst for righteousness, and right on down the list. They will work those things in us, and we'll find ourselves knowing the reality of which Jesus kind of started off cluing us in on. So there's how the Sermon on the Mount opens. And then after this, lots of instructions. But take them as just a kind of a reference point.